Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Early Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:01 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is Friday, June 16th. So it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought I'd kick off with probably one of the biggest, most secular trends there is in the world, which is the purchasing power of the dollar, and it has done nothing but decline since about 1933. And what I think is most particularly relevant is that this is a log scale chart, and even on the log scale, the pace of the depreciation has in fact accelerated since March of 2021. So we are 2 years into an acceleration in the decline of the purchasing power of the dollar. Now, it's easy to say that the dollar has been reasonably firm over the last 2 years, although it has been weaker recently. So what this is really helping to graphically illustrate is that the purchasing power of the dollar has declined in excess of 5% a year for 2 years in a row. And that's inflation. So when we think about why prices have gone up, well, the nominal price has gone up, but the purchasing power of the currency has gone down. So that's why we have this rather difficult environment where the perception of value has changed. There is still a real push on to invest in the big new thing. And I was thinking these exact same things at the beginning of the year. I wrote a piece just thinking about what the surprises could be in 2023. But one thing that I was very conscious of was that we had very oversold conditions. We were due a bounce. We got a bounce. And we were going to have a conflict. And there would be a conflict between value and those that are looking at very tight monetary conditions and thinking, well, that's not good news. And then those that are looking at their favorite asset, which was deeply oversold and was due a bounce and has had a bounce. And then, of course, you had ChatGPT arriving on the scene and everyone gets super excited about it. And then we get this huge rally in the large cap segment of the market. And when we look at that relative performance of those eight companies compared to the entire market cap of the NYSE, then what we have is this ratio that has broken out to new all-time highs and extended that advance in here this week. And this has been a really incredible rebound, considering that right at the beginning of this year, it was oversold, certainly, and down to about 16%. Now it is up to about 24%. In other words, the market cap of those eight companies has increased by 50% more than the entire market cap of the entire NYSE in the last less than 6 months. So that is a huge rebound. And I think it is worth beginning to start to put that into perspective. So we definitely have overbought conditions, but the conflict arises when you have central banks that are worried about inflation and the fact that it is sticky, and they are continuing to raise rates. And we're getting all the normal things that happen when they start raising rates into restrictive territory. So the first thing is you get an inverted yield curve, and the yield curve continues to invert. It's down now to negative 95 basis points, and that is coming back into the region of the lows from back in 1980 through 1982. And that's normal. You would anticipate that you'd get an inverted yield curve. But of course, because we had rates so very low, then we've had an exaggerated rebound because yields were so low, they had a lot further to jump. And that initial jump is often where you get the biggest percentage changes, which is exactly what we've had over the last year. So then we can also think about the banking sector. And we'll just look at the S&P 500 banks. And we had a big peak at the beginning of 2022, and then it dropped down into the end of last year and rebounded. But then we had strife in the smaller portion of the banking sector in March, several bankruptcies, a big increase in the availability of liquidity, and basically the government and the Federal Reserve stepping in and basically saying that they're going to guarantee all deposits. So that's not going to stop individual banks from experiencing stress in the future, but it does mean that there's less risk that there's going to be a big bank run. And of course, that was what brought down Silicon Valley Bank, for example. But I think we also have to just pay attention to the fact that that was a massive reaction against the prevailing trend in early 2022. We've had a period of right hand extension, a big decline, and now subsequently, it has not, at least yet, pushed back up into the overhead trading range. What this range that's been underway for the last 3 months has done is unwind the oversold condition. So, I think it would be very presumptuous to say that we have seen the worst of the selling pressure within the banking sector, particularly as interest rates are continuing to rise and liquidity conditions are beginning to tighten. And then we've also had a hiatus in the what would normally be the case, that during a period of monetary tightening, you would anticipate that high yield spreads would begin to rally. And that's exactly what happened in 21 and 22. But then they basically stopped. And they're hovering here around the 500 basis point level. Now, historically, it is when you start to see high yield spreads popping up through 500 basis points and trending higher. That is generally when, or it's representative of stress in the capital markets. We can see that there have been several occasions where spreads got up to 700 or 800 basis points and then came straight back down again, and each one of those was an important low. And then we also had, of course, the big blowout in 2008. So we're on the border of problematic levels, but they're not problematic yet. And then I think it's also relevant to highlight the fact that the number of bankruptcies is rising. And this is, I think, a very good way of illustrating that fact. So far in 2023, the number of bankruptcies has exceeded the number for this time of the year on every year except for 2016. And we're already well on the way to exceeding the number of bankruptcies from 2022. And I think it would be reasonable to anticipate that this year will be a normal year for bankruptcies relative to the period where a lot of payment holidays were forced upon creditors. This would also be representative of what we should anticipate, that there will be more bankruptcies as liquidity conditions tighten. So these are all things that are starting to happen. Then I think it's also relevant to think about the oil market. Surging oil prices are one of the leading causes of recessions, and prices went from negative $40 to $140 in the space of approximately 2 years, and now prices have come back down again, basically halving from the peak that was put in at the beginning of 2022. Now the price is still hovering here, but the big surge in energy prices, particularly in Europe, is obviously having a more significant knock-on effect because of the vast quantity of cash that had to be printed in order to forfend the possibility that the war in Ukraine would cause a depression in Europe. So Europe is now starting to take that money back out of the system. And what we've definitely seen here is that European banks have been steady. definitely firming from the region of the 200-day moving average, but it is the smaller banks are probably going to experience the stress. So it's the regional banks in the USA are most exposed to the commercial property sector, and they are experiencing some stress in the short term. And then it's the smaller banks in Europe are having their TLTRO loans called back in from the ECB, and that's about 500 billion that they're taking out of circulation. Now, we can also just remind ourselves that the Federal Reserve is not the only central bank that is reducing the size of its balance sheet. And the ECB has taken $1 trillion out of circulation so far, and the trend of that continues. So we have the total assets of central banks. If we aggregate them all and redenominate them into US dollars, we had a meaningful contraction in 2022, and it has been reasonably steady over the course of the last 6 months, but that is mostly because the dollar has been coming down. So even though the Federal Reserve has been reducing the size of its balance sheet, and so has the ECB, the weakness of the dollar has in fact supported the this measure. But we're definitely depending on Japan continuing to inflate the size of its balance sheet. And we can look then at what that looks like in yen terms. So it's still right in the region of the all-time peak. But then if we redenominate that, in fact, what we have in dollar terms is that it's been contracting because the yen has been so weak. And the yen, in fact, has weakened again in here today. I think it's important to just flip this around and look at a really long-term chart, because what's happening in Japan raises important questions for much of the rest of the world. So, if we look at about as much back history as we can lay our hands on, we had this big advance in the yen from the early 1970s all the way through to an important peak in 1995. And that was briefly exceeded in 2012, and then subsequently it has really meaningfully declined. We can also just highlight the fact that there were important lows around, or at least put in 2007 and in 2015, and now those lows are offering resistance. This looks like a secular trend lower. And if that's the case, then we should be thinking more of we should be thinking about Japan with more of a critical eye. And what exactly is going on there that the currency is so weak against the dollar, which itself is quite weak? And then let's just flip it around and look at some of the countries with which Japan competes. So particularly the Korean won is breaking out in very emphatic fashion relative to the yen. And this was a big upper dynamic in here this week, but it is now on the cusp of breaking out of this range that's been in play since 2015, and potentially moving all the way back up towards those peaks in 2007. So that's going to create a competitiveness issue for a lot of those Korean companies. And we have a very similar situation with the euro yen, where the euro has been resurgent and very clearly breaking straight up and through the 150 area in here this week. So this is now a very substantial breakout and well on its way to approaching those peaks from back in 2007 and 2008. So of all the countries in the world, Japan is working hardest to devalue its currency. And one of the most important factors about devaluing yen, particularly because they're holding interest rates down and still engaging in yield curve control, well, this is the yen carry trade. So they are supplying yen to the market, they're actively devaluing the currency, and they're doing so with a very low borrowing cost. So, if we're thinking about where is the liquidity and leverage coming from to support this incredibly impressive acceleration higher in AI-related sectors, well, then the devaluation of the yen is an important part of that. And Japanese equities are reflecting that depreciation. So the Nikkei has been in this staircase step sequence uptrend now for quite some time. And let me put that back into local currency terms. So the more back history we look at, in fact, the more consistent it looks that we have these ranges, one above the last, with the exception of the a brief dip in 2020, then another range and another breakout, and it is rallying towards this 35,000 level. If the trend is going to remain consistent, well, then 35,000 will be about as high as it goes, and then subsequently we'll move into another ranging phase. Now, of course, that does not preclude the possibility that it will accelerate from here, or that the pace of the advance will go up, that the consolidation might be mild, and then subsequently the pace of the advance will pick up from here, because the trend of Japanese equities has been higher for quite some time. And we are approaching the peak from back in 1989, and it's taken an awfully long time to get back to those levels. So, what exactly is going on in Japan? Why are they devaluing their currency so actively? Well, it's very simple. They have this vast volume of debt. Now, a lot of it is held internally, and they don't have a lot of foreign creditors that they have to please. But the reality is that it is a multiple of the size of the economy. So they really can't tolerate higher interest rate costs, most particularly debt servicing costs for rolling over that debt. So at They're attempting then to try and reinstall some kind of inflationary bias. So, when you have really terrible demographics and the birth rate went down to a new low this month, then you really are stumped for how to create inflation. Because, simply put, that people who don't have children, they are not under nearly the same kind of pressure to spend money on housing, education, and sports and play and clothing for the next generation. And they can lead much less consumption-driven lifestyles. So that's certainly a factor in Japan. One of the major issues they had with getting inflation going prior to 2022 was the fact that the rest of the world was disinflating, and it's very hard to get inflation going when the rest of the world is enjoying a secular period of disinflation. And because they have this vast overhang of debt, well, on the one hand, they are certainly encouraging their companies, and the Japanese government might be heavily indebted, but the companies have been exceptionally conservatively run. Now, Mitsubishi Corp is really accelerating higher, and it was up another 133 yen in here today. So, this is a very clear performance by a major industrial. And I think that what this is beginning to look like is that Japan is not only printing the money it requires, but at least some of that money is being redeployed into reindustrialization. So, Mitsubishi Heavy, for example, has a offtake, or well, it's a license from I think it's Lockheed Martin to produce the most advanced U.S. fighter jets. And it is clearly breaking on the upside here. So, Japan is likely to basically print the money it needs in order to reindustrialize, remilitarize. And they're doing it very quietly. And not much of the rest of the world seems to be paying a lot of attention to it. And when I say that, well, if we look at the hedged exposure to Japan, then we can see that DXJ has really rallied here, and it's accelerating now, and that is being purely driven by the devaluation of the currency. But if we look at the assets committed to the actual ETF, well, they haven't really moved. Back in 2015, this was a $15 billion ETF. Today, it's closer to two and a bit, and it's only just breaking out. So I think that there's not really a big swell of interest in hedged exposure to Japan right now. And a good reason for that is because of this huge move that we've had in those technology companies. So then Nvidia has led the way forward on the logic that the best thing to do in a mining boom is to sell picks and shovels. Then people have been more than happy to massively inflate the advance. So prices are pausing around the $400 level, but they're not coming down just yet. What we have seen, though, is that some of the also rans are beginning to roll over a little. So AMD, for example, did not rally as much, and now it is having some difficulty keeping up the pace. Microsoft has been the company that has embraced AI more wholeheartedly than just about anyone else, and the share has rebounded all the way back to $350. So now it does beg the question, what's next? I've played quite a bit with ChatGPT, and I've also been I haven't yet had my had a chance to play around with Apple's VR, but I have played with lots of other VR systems. And one thing that I can say for certain is that paying $3,500 for a system where the battery only lasts for 2 hours and you have to carry it around in your pocket is not going to be the kind of big growth engine that the market is willing to price in. And Apple now is right on the cusp of a $3 trillion market cap. So another 3% on the upside is going to cross that very important Rubicon. But is it worth it? I think is the big question, because even Apple, which is one of the best capitalized companies in the world, is trading on a PE of 31. And then the price to sales ratio is about 7. Now, 7 isn't as high as lots of other companies, but it is a reasonably high valuation. So, like I said, there was a conflict at the beginning of this year between all of the factors that are pointing towards the potential for a recession. And then the fact that a lot of the favorite tech companies were or had experienced a deep pullback and were due some rebound. So this is the time when that happens. You get a rebound during an inverted yield curve because people rejoice at the fact that the central bank is finally beginning to tackle the inflationary problem, and then they start pricing in the recovery before you actually get the economic contraction. And that's exactly what we're getting right now. So you get a rebound, and let's just to put that into perspective, let's just simply look at a couple of those examples. I think really it is to ram it home, because this will make the point, I think, quite well. The initial inversion of the yield curve, it was really around the beginning of 2006. So let's put that up on the S&P 500. So we had the initial inversion right at the beginning of 2006, and then let's just see what happened next. So right there at the beginning of 2006, the market was trading at about 1250. So between the beginning of that year and at the peaks put in October of 2007, so that was between the peak and the initial inversion was approximately 22 months, and the market went up 27 are 26%. Now let's just do the same thing. We'll look at the initial inversion. First, it inverted in 1998 and not for very long. And then it inverted again in January of 2000. And then the inversion bottomed not long afterwards, and then it really accelerated higher. But let's just look at the initial inversion in 1998. So we can just zoom back out here and look at what happened. So we had the initial inversion and a bit of a wobble in 1998. And then from that low in 1998, the price eventually went up 58%. And that was a really spectacular advance for the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ went up even more. And between the low and the peak, it stretched almost out for just a bit more than 2 years, August and August. So 2 full years on the upside. So now if we just simply look at what's been happening more recently, well, we've had the initial inversion. So the yield curve inverted right there in March of 2022. So this was in March of 22 right there. And then the market bottomed in September. So we're currently about 9 months, really the beginning of October. So, but about 9 months into this rebound. And the price has gone up meaningfully. And we're now approaching the 4,500 point level. So we've definitely seen that following the initial inversion, it is normal to see a rebound. And that is exactly what we're getting right now. What we also know about 2000 and 2007 is that when the eventual peak was put in and the yield curve spread starts to rally, and particularly as it is trending higher up through the zero bound, that usually coincides with some of the greatest selling pressure. And it is normal to have a really impressive, convincing, bullish argument. So I think what the head of AI at Meta had to say over the last few days is particularly interesting. So one thing about Meta was they really got burned by the Cambridge Analytica scandal in the aftermath of the 2016 election in the USA. So it wasn't long after that that Meta decided that they were going to open source their data and that they would supply data for free to AI companies. And they basically believed that in doing so, they would help to foster the industry, benefit themselves, but most particularly defray some of the legal liability that they could potentially face down the road. And there is definitely going to be legal liability. For example, OpenAI this week was accused, and I think it was proven, that they had trained their AI on YouTube videos. But of course, those YouTube videos belong to Google. And this trust and safety issue is a big one in the adoption of AI systems, because what you're doing is you're basically giving your data to the AI to learn on, but then the AI is leased to the company, and the beneficial owner of the AI system is then going to have a more educated product that it can sell to someone else using your proprietary data. That's obviously a massive conflict of interest. And I got two emails today from different services I'd never heard of in the past, offering AI consultancy and applications to me. So there is a huge boom on in terms of trying to get sales for these products. But the broader point was that the head of AI at Meta basically said that they're not going to take over. And I do think that we are at an interesting point here, that over the last decade, I can think of really three very big hype cycles. One was around the evolution of solid-state batteries. So, if anyone remembers, solid-state batteries were sold on the idea, or well, promised on the idea that they would double range, they would massively accelerate the charging time, and then they would have long longevity. They were initially promised in 2017, 2019, 2021. They're promised in 2023. Now it's 25 or 2027. So that's obviously problematic that the lead time in terms of the big promise made, the investments that are created, the inflation of those smaller companies, all of that, and then we still don't have a product. Second, a big hype cycle. Was around self-driving cars, and we were led to believe that we'd all have a self-driving car by 2023. And what it is increasingly looking like is that it is really hard, and that it's possible to get up to some level of self-driving, particularly on freeways, and the car might even take the exit for you. But that as soon as you get off the freeway, the number of variables escalates, and then subsequently, it becomes incredibly difficult. So, I've seen lots of presentations and really inspiring stuff from the AI lab in MIT about how they're using a better algorithm to identify priority points in terms of the vision and teaching the AI how to see and recognize important points. So all of that, it doesn't mean that self-driving cars won't be in the future, but to get there is going to require not an it's not an iterative process. I think this is something that is perhaps the most important point, that in order to get to a new battery chemistry, you basically have to retool. You have to come up with something that's completely different, and then that is going to be the new standard. It's not an iterative process. So you don't just build a piece of infrastructure and build a little bit more and build a little bit more. Because that's basically what has happened so far with batteries, is that you put more cells in the vehicle, it'll go further. You put the cells in different kinds of packaging, or you put them into the bed of the vehicle, and it enhances the speed with which they can be manufactured, and that brings down prices and it builds up the market. But the cells themselves aren't really all that different, and we've had, and that was something else that that Tesla had just a couple of years ago, that they had this technology conference, and they talked about all the incremental changes they had made so that they're going to be able to enhance their productive capacity for batteries, but they did not announce a game-changing new chemistry. And I think it's the same thing with AI and the self-driving cars, that it basically requires not an iterative process, but a step change in the ability of artificial intelligence systems to approach the complication of driving. And it's about processing power, it's about communication, but mostly it's about just the processing of huge amounts of data and then nanosecond speed decision making. And in order to get to an efficient horizon for the computing power, that is something that is exceptionally difficult. And I think it's very similar in terms of AI, that the kind of macros that the large language models can perform are really impressive. And then we can see that it can answer questions and it can write little notes and it can even suggest drafts for programming language. But that's not general AI, where it and general AI basically means that it knows everything, it can do anything. And There's a real danger in anthropomorphizing AI. People look at their dogs and they think, well, do they understand me? And people look at their cats and think, well, it does understand me and it chooses to ignore me. But the reality is that dogs are dogs, cats are cats, people are people. And artificial intelligence is artificial intelligence. It's not a person. It doesn't have the same priorities, ambitions, needs, wants of a person. And therefore, it doesn't make a lot of sense to attribute those kinds of emotions to AI. And yet, we are, and on top of that, we are still far away from general AI. That doesn't mean that those kinds of things can't happen in the future, but it's not a near-term objective. Now, the enhanced type of macro level applications that AI can perform today is certainly a productivity enhancer. There is no question about that. Now, I think it's rather important, though, to highlight that we are getting up into really quite overbought condition territory. I do apologize. I do not look at RSIs all that often. The RSI is right at, well, it's above 70, so that is about as overbought as it gets. And we do not have a diversion, a divergence, I should say. The RSI has not pulled back below the 70 bound with the index hitting new highs, but the index did hit a new high today, and the RSI has rolled over a little. So I think that the balance of probabilities here is that we are going to get at least some pause and consolidation, and that might already be starting in here. Now, we've definitely also seen that companies like Tesla have rebounded, and it does seem to be coming out the other end of this price war that they instigated in better form. Now, Stellantis is joining the fray, and they are now announcing they're going to have a $25, excuse me, $25,000 EV on the market in early 2024. And Ford is also cutting prices and looking to compete with Tesla in the US market, and it's been rewarded for that. But there can't, not every company is going to be a winner. So some of these smaller companies that don't have the earnings, well, then they're not performing nearly as admirably. And Rivian looks like it is susceptible to additional downside. Lucid Group, they're talking about building their first factory in China, but I think it's quite likely that the company is going to have to need ongoing financial assistance from the Saudi government. And ultimately, Saudi Arabia will end up owning the whole thing. But at least the share is reasonably steady. Now, I've been chatting to people. I like to talk to as many people as I can come into contact with about how do they experience stuff. So one thing that is clear is that some of these small companies look like they will go bust. And that's part of the trend of bankruptcies. And we continue to see that it's these small companies that are the what we might think about as zombies, and companies that have lots of access to liquidity, lots of people willing to bet in on the future, but not particularly successful in growing sales. And then I was in the supermarket yesterday. And I heard an answer to a question that I thought was particularly relevant. There were a couple of these the people chatting at the till. There were one person was saying that the union had agreed to or had successfully negotiated a pay rise, so they were going to get $18.50 an hour. And then the other person was saying, well, isn't it funny that we don't have enough people to work here? And the head office is saying that there are lots of jobs available, and yet they're firing people here. So That, I think, is the perfect example of why the job openings data isn't really reliable. Kroger is well below the peak in 2022. Everyone was spending a lot more on groceries in 2021 and 2020, and that really favored the supermarkets. Now, people are eating out more, they're traveling more, so prices have begun to range. Now, the stock was well off the lows in here this week, but it absolutely needs to hold the region of the 1,000-day moving average. I think this is a graphic example of what we can anticipate, that as interest rates rise, as liquidity conditions tighten, and then, of course, financial assets are a significant factor in the financial conditions. So financial conditions are beginning to pull back again, and they got about as tight in 2022 as they had been in or during the pandemic, and also in late 2018. And now financial conditions are easing again. So we have easier financial conditions in the last 3 or 4 months, and that has helped to inflate asset prices. And we're in a situation where the Federal Reserve has said that they're pausing. But I do think that it is probably a pause. And when we look at the dynamics of the bond market, they really do need to get inflation under control. And even though we're in an environment where stocks are still in an overextended position and continuing to extend it, the cost of servicing the national debt in the USA has gone from 4 to 600 billion in the space of the last 2 years. So that's an additional $200 billion cost. And the cost of issuing new debt has greatly increased. And then you have the deficits that are being run are on par with what we saw in 2000 and 2021. So it's not like there is suddenly a big fiscal or a desire to curtail spending. Because of the jump in interest rates, the Federal Reserve is no longer sending dividends back to the Treasury. So the US Treasury has a situation where they have to continue to borrow money, and they have less coming in because tax receipts have trended downwards. And so they have less tax, less remittances from the Fed, and then the cost of servicing the debt has gone up. So all of that is contributing to some of the inflationary pressures are because of the deficit spending and the availability of credit in the market. But the broader picture is that the 10-year yield is continuing to hold, give or take, around the 3.75% level. And it was in mildly positive territory in here today. I think that it is more likely than not that we're going to get a reversion back down towards that 1,000-day moving average in due course. But it isn't happening just yet. And there is obviously an issue with people or investors having faith in treasuries. Because one thing that I thought was also interesting was Jay Powell basically parroted what Jeff Gundlach has been saying, which is that all you really need to do to tell you where interest rates are going to go is to look at the 2-year. So the 2-year in bond markets thought that bond yields would begin to contract in around now, and that is not looking likely. So the 2-year is pushing back up again. And if it breaks up through 5%, well, then that is going to imply that there's going to be significant additional rate hikes. So we had a big pullback in technology in 2022 because of this jump in interest rates. And suddenly bonds looked a lot more attractive. and you could suddenly get a return from your bond portfolio that looked reasonable. So there wasn't nearly the same pressure to own highly valued non-profitable companies. But if bond yields break higher again, then that is going to greatly enhance the potential that a recession will be inevitable. And we're definitely also seeing a reasonably sanguine attitude towards the housing sector. So the S&P 500 housing index has popped on the upside. Now, I do realize that I've spent a lot of this broadcast talking about the USA, talking about Japan, because of their debt issues. So it's probably worth then just also thinking about where debt issues reside everywhere else. And what's happening in China, I think, is particularly relevant. So they have a or they've been fudging just how much debt there is in the country for a long time. And the government itself does not have a large debt burden, but then you have all the local governments. And since they rely on remittances from Beijing, then it's not like the Chinese central government is going to let regional governments go bust. So debt in the country is at extraordinarily high levels. And the 10-year yield has begun to find support now. And the possibility here is that we're going to start to see more substantive fiscal stimulus. So we know that Japan is a major contributor to global liquidity, and China could be about to join that party. That wouldn't be particularly beneficial for the bond market, and we should anticipate that yields would rise. And but it will help to stoke demand for commodities. It will help to revitalize some of the country economies that depend on China. So, New Zealand, for example, has reported a negative growth, and now the New Zealand dollar is bouncing. So, if China is going to enhance its fiscal stimulus, then that's going to be beneficial for all the countries like New Zealand or Australia that are going to be sending money there, or I guess sending goods there and taking money from there. So the Australian dollar is also popping on the upside. And the renminbi, which got all the way down to test the 7.2 area, has stabilized. So it did not follow through on the upside today, and this was not a bullish day for the dollar either. So we're in an environment where there was a lot of competition to strengthen up currencies in the fight against inflation in 2021 and 2022. And now, as economies slow down, I think it is more likely that we're going to see competitive currency devaluation. And the renminbi is in the region of its lows. Now, China, above all else, is trying to enhance confidence in the market. So that is helping to support the outlook for Hong Kong shares. And the H-share index has closed this week above the 200-day moving average, and it's testing the sequence of lower rally highs that's been in place for the last 5 months. And then India is increasingly looking to be a beneficiary of rising geopolitical tensions with China. And then it has this massive young population and enhanced appeal as a manufacturing sector. So that's certainly helping to support inflows. And the Nifty index is closing at, or at least close to, a new all-time high in here this week. And importantly here, the rupee has strengthened up as well. Now, it has not quite yet broken through the 200-day moving average, but generally speaking, the times when the rupee is trading higher than the MA tend to be among the most rewarding from the perspective of foreign investors in Indian markets. And the Bombay Banks Index is pausing here in the region of the peak from last year, but it does generally tend to be a lead indicator. So if it pops on the upside, that's going to be further confirmation that we're moving into a more benign environment for Indian markets. Then in Latin America, Mexico has the Mexican peso continues to rally, and this is a really significant break of the long-term trend. So when we think about just how weak the US dollar is, then the Mexican peso in particular is a great example of how getting in control of inflation and then having a broader theme to support it is certainly working in its favor. So the iShares MSCI Mexico ETF continues to pop on the upside. And I'm rather kicking myself that I didn't use just a brief period of weakness 2 weeks ago to initiate a position. I really would prefer to buy on weakness, but I think that this is a clear case of investors beginning to look at Mexico as a viable investment destination. We haven't seen a lot of money directly flowing into manufacturing or building factories just yet, but Tesla is building a gigafactory in Monterrey, and they anticipate taking between 12 and 15 months. So that's quite a bit slower than the factory they built in China. But the reason for that slowdown is more important, and it's not because of domestic inefficiency, but rather that they want to build their enhanced manufacturing capacity there. And they aim to build a smaller Model Y, which is going to be a more affordable vehicle. And that's going to be a significant capital appreciation, or a capital investment in manufacturing in Mexico. And I think that's just the beginning of the kind of nearshoring we're going to see there. And particularly, they want to build the processing facilities for lithium in the country as well. This is also a very clear theme of innovation within the emerging markets. We definitely tend to see more geopolitical tensions between the USA and China. You have Henry Kissinger talking about the inevitability of a war between China and the USA over Taiwan unless dialogue persists and is fruitful. But then we can think about the third-party countries that they see this great power competition and they have their own people that they need to look after. So they are in a much better position to talk about how can we basically game the system so that we can sell to both of those parties. So India has done well with that they're still buying Russian oil, and there's the possibility there won't be any Indian journalists in China before very long. So they're decoupling from China, but they remain close to Russia. They're cozying up to the USA and the other NATO-ish countries. And I think that is how they're going to plot an independent path through a very tense geopolitical environment. And I think that when we look at what's happening in Argentina, where a central bank has basically run out of liquid dollars, so we're on the cusp of another significant debt crisis in Argentina. Well, what they're in fact doing now is selling renminbi, so to try and support the Argentine peso. And of course, China is a major investor in Argentina, and the ability of countries to play one of the geopolitical heavyweights against the other is likely to be rather a profitable enterprise. The trend of governance is something that is going to be progressively more important as we think about the future, the active devaluation of currencies. The fact that we have hundreds of millions of people entering the workforce over the course of the next decade, and many of them will be in emerging markets. And the need for governance to continue to improve is very significant. And I think what's happening in Nigeria right now is particularly interesting. You have a new president and beginning to introduce reform measures. And he's a product of what is in an inherently corrupt regime. And I think that is probably true of everyone who comes to power in Nigeria. But the kinds of measures that have been introduced, like replacing the central bank governor, trying to allow the naira to float, and addressing some of the intransigent problems, that is likely to be beneficial. Again, I haven't pulled the trigger just yet, but I do want to own Nigeria, and I think that this is an interesting place to think about owning it, and I will be buying on weakness, any kind of weakness, just so that I have a nicer entry opportunity. But Nigeria has a vast young population and a very, I think, entrepreneurial mindset for that population. So there is certainly the potential that countries will do well in this environment. And of course, when we talk about the devaluation of currencies, and that's really likely to be beneficial for gold. Now, gold prices have been ranging here below the 2000 level. And if we just look at what's been happening this week, then we had the initial drop yesterday and then quite a significant rebound. And the price was relatively unchanged in here today. It's a broad pause in the region of a big psychological level like 2000. But as we move into tighter global financial conditions and the, I think, inevitability of a US recession, then we are moving towards the point where there will be greater monetary and fiscal accommodation. And there is clear pressure under governments to try and find money to address the social inequities. So that's likely to continue to devalue the purchasing power of currencies. And gold should do well in that kind of environment. And I don't think this is anything other than a consolidation in the region of the previous peaks. And silver prices having been quite overbought, consolidated, came back in to test the region of the 200-day moving average and have rebounded quite impressively. So it has now quite clearly broken that sequence of lower rally highs that's been in place since 2020. And now we have a sequence of higher reaction lows, and it is bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. So I continue to think that this is just a big first step above the base. And during this bull market, silver will exceed the price peak of 2011. And realistically, that's only a double from where we are right now. When we look at the purchasing power parity of, let me see if I can find it. I'm trying to find the purchasing power parity of gold. And I am not succeeding. So, when we look at gold, I do apologize. I'm there we go. Well, this is in Australian dollars. I am rather surprised that I cannot find my own charts, and I do apologize. So let me see if I can just pull this up. There we go. And sometimes it really is the most obvious ticker, but I did create this chart 10 years ago. So, in terms of purchasing power parity, the price of gold got up to test that peak in 2011, and then paused. And I just think that this is this whole period of consolidation over the last 3 years is just a consolidation, and that we will see gold breaking out to new all-time highs, and that will exceed the peaks put in back in 1979. So that would be a very meaningful appreciation for gold, and it would be a clear break on the upside to new all-time highs. And I do want to also just highlight Bitcoin. I thought it was likely that Bitcoin would bottom at the beginning of this year, or at some point this year, and it has done that. And now the price is hovering here in the region of the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving averages. And this is a potential area of support. I think it's important that prices are hovering here in an area of support on pretty much the same time that the SEC in the USA is suing Coinbase and Binance for running illegal exchanges. Now, I think that that is rather egregious, since Coinbase has been attempting to engage with regulators for a long time, and we're asking for rules and how they should perform, and now they're just being sued for trying to do the right thing. The big point, though, is that Coinbase doesn't really trade in its own coin, and that puts it, I think, at a significantly lower risk of actually going out of business than Binance does. But at least the share is just going sideways. Now, in the event that Bitcoin bounces from here, and then the news of the SEC lawsuits flushed out some of the weaker holders, there's the potential that Bitcoin could bounce from here, then that is likely to be beneficial for related assets. And then we can think about where we are in the cycle. The reality is that Bitcoin does best when there's a lot of money getting printed. And there's a very clear 4-year cycle to that. On each of the occasions when you've had a big run on the upside for crypto, it has coincided with a big round of new liquidity. And the halving is going to happen in April of 2024. So that means that we are considerably less than a year out from the halving. And it is quite normal that ahead of the halving, you get some volatility. And then, even immediately after the halving, you get a little bit of weakness. But subsequently, prices accelerate. So we're getting the rebound now. We may get a consolidation or some weakness maybe towards the end of the year. And then we should start to see prices bottoming out. And there's the potential that if the cycle is still in place, then the next round of big global liquidity infusions, where we see balance sheets ramping higher for central banks, well, then that is probably likely to be a 2024 event based upon the cycle in Bitcoin. But certainly some of these assets are beginning to bounce in here right now. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.